Back when your concert career was starting, and indeed was in full swing, you had a reputation of being rather choosy about your pianos. You wouldn't play just any old Steinway. Why is that? Is there some special need of your nervous system, and is your approach to the piano different from most soloists?
I suppose so. I'd like to think that it is, in any case. I can't imagine anyone who would want their approach to be identical with that of any other person.
You mean the big burnished singing tone is not a universal goal?
No, I don't think so.
Or at least not your goal.
Not my goal, not quite. I found also that there were certain instruments that became prerequisite for me, certain instruments against which I tended to gauge all others. And I had in those days, I still have it, though I use it very seldom nowadays, but I had in those days an extraordinary instrument which was built in 1895 in the city of Boston by the company of Chickering. It had precisely those qualities of tactile grab and immediacy that I'd always believed pianos could have, but it was a turn-of-the-century instrument with all of the sound liabilities thereunto pertaining. And I decided that when I was in search of a more contemporary and more viable instrument for concert use, I was going to try and design it with something like that characteristic. And in the days when I did trod the boards and tour the concert circuits here and occasionally, very occasionally, abroad, there was hell to pay, really, if I had to encounter a piano that was too different. And one did sometimes, because certain action characteristics were just so unassimilatable in relation to the piano that was my standard and the basis of my judgment. I remember one time I was in Israel and playing with the Israeli Philharmonic, mm-hmm. series of concerts, I think 8 or 9 in about 11 days, and that in itself was a very difficult experience. I'd never done that before. I never had that kind of schedule. And I played on what was possibly the worst concert instrument I've ever seen in my life. I'm sure they could do no better in Tel Aviv 10 years ago, but it was a pretty terrible piano. And it got to the point where after 3 or 4 performances of some Beethoven concertos, I could no longer control this instrument in any coherent way. It was running away from me. It was like a car with power steering, and I was a driver who was used to stick shift, you know, and it was frightening, really. In any event, on the afternoon of the 4th or 5th concert, whatever it was, I decided that I simply had to reinstate my mental image of some other instrument, while obviously pursuing a concert with this particular instrument. I had no choice. There was no other piano to call upon. Mm-hmm. So I went out to a sand dune, which was about 15 miles north of Tel Aviv, and faced the Mediterranean at a place called Herzliya by the Sea. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right or not. And I sat there for about half an hour in a Hertz car, which I had rented from Hertz Jerusalem, which idea rather delights me, I must say. And I tried to feel and to recall the sight and the sound and the tactilia of this very ancient Chickering of mine. And I tried to play through, I think it was the Beethoven B-flat major concerto, the second concerto, which I was to play that night, on that piano mentally while sitting on a sand dune. I felt myself really to have been playing and to have gone through that. This sounds very weird, John, and I swear to you it happened. It's a true story, and I can find you witnesses. I then went to the hall that evening in Tel Aviv and sat down at this dreadful piano, whose maker shall remain unidentified, and began a performance which, for the first couple of phrases, absolutely terrified me because the keys were barely moving. I was moving my fingers in relation to that remembered perspective and not in relation to the instrument that was, in fact, in front of me at that particular moment. And so the first couple of phrases barely sounded at all. When we had adjusted for that, something came out that was really quite extraordinary. There was a sense of, I suppose, detachment and removal with which one couldn't live indefinitely. Eventually, you would be swayed back by the perspectives
of that reality.
But for a 30-minute concerto performance, you could do it. And afterwards, I was in the dressing room, and a very dear old lady with a thick German accent, Central European accent in any case, came backstage. I have no idea who she was. And she said, "Mr. Gould, I want to say to you that I have attended several of your performances already, and this performance tonight was something very special. We didn't hear that quality before. It was as though you were in another world." I said, "Oh, thank you very much. That's very kind of you, madam." "Yes, it was absolutely the most extraordinary Mozart I've ever heard in my life." And it was, of course, Beethoven. Nevertheless, a well-meant compliment.
Well, a triumph of the nervous system over battle conditions.
Indeed.
This instrument you're seated at, Glenn, is this a regular government-issue Steinway? It looks a little bit shabby and down at the heels.
Well, it's followed me about for rather a long time, though it's had a couple of easy years sitting at Columbia Studio for the most part. It's not quite government-issue. It's vintage Steinway, I think 1938 or 39, with substantial improvements, as I would like to think of them, that began around 1960. We've put about 7 years into refining certain qualities that it seemed to have natively, and to perfecting them along lines that seemed to me important if one's going to use the piano to peruse Baroque repertoire especially. It was essentially designed for Bach. At one time, I found it important to have a different sort of piano for every kind of music that one played. I no longer do. I use this for everything now. This is my Richard Strauss piano. It's my Bach piano. It's my piano for playing William Byrd, the English Tudor composer, and that I've lately been doing with great delight. It's a chest of whistles, it's a set of virginals, it's just about anything that you want to make of it. It's an extraordinary piano. I think also it can be made to sound a bit orchestral. We've tried to do that in the Beethoven Fifth Symphony as arranged by Liszt. We've played it very orchestrally, and it has a rather fat and fluffy sound for that recording because we wanted it to sound that way. Do you want to hear a bit of it?
Let's. It's an amazing transformation, actually. When you compare that with a well-tempered clavier, it doesn't sound like the same piano. There's an old problem. It's not really so much of a problem anymore since we've all grown so accustomed to it here at Columbia, but you are also rather well known as a vocalist, and we have to go to rather elaborate lengths to keep your vocal performances that accompany your keyboard performances out of the microphone so they don't appear on the final record. Can you tell us or describe to us what function this vocal accompaniment serves while you play?
That's very difficult, and it's one of those centipedal questions. You know, Schoenberg once said that he would not willingly be asked by any of his composition students exactly why such and such a process served him well, because mm-hmm. it was in danger of making him feel like that centipede who was asked in which order it moved its hundred legs, and afterwards it could move no legs at all. There's something impotent-making about that question. I'm rather afraid of it.
I think then you should avoid it. I don't want to take any chances.
I'll answer it in one paragraph or less. I can't do without it. I would if I could. It's a terrible distraction. I don't like it. I would resent any artist whose records I bought indulging himself that way, and I don't see why anyone puts up with it. We do the best we can. We put as many baffles around the piano as we can. I can only say I play very much less well if I don't indulge in a few vocal elaborations.
Well, there's obviously some kind of recreative element or generation going on in there while you play.
I think there's a wishful thinking aspect, too. That is the way I would like my phrases to be made, and I'm never quite able to do that at the keyboard.
Glenn, I noticed you have a very unorthodox method of working, of recording. Most artists, when they come into the studio, have an absolute fixed idea of what they want to do. They've taken a piece, they've played it in concert in front of various audiences and honed it down to a certain style that they feel is right for that piece. They come in and they do it. Now, I've seen sessions where you've come in with music that you obviously know completely and play it in what seems to me five different styles and five different tempi, each of them seeming legitimate. And then subsequently you go in and you choose from among those you've laid down. Now, that's very unorthodox.
Yeah, well, sometimes it's a total inability to make decisions, Sean. I think I take my cue from soap opera actors and actresses who tend to learn their lines the night before and forget them the moment they've done it. This sounds a very strange thing to say, but I have in many cases come to the studio without the least notion of how I was going to approach the work that we were to play that day. I've come in perhaps with five or six, as it then seemed to me, equally valid ideas. And if we were lucky and if time permitted and if the producer had the patience, we would try all five or six of those possible interpretations. And perhaps none of them worked, in which case we'd come back in a couple of weeks and try a seventh. If two or three did work, We then repair to an editing cubicle within a week or so and listen to them. And really, the week at least is necessary for some kind of perspective. The judgments that you make a week later are never those that you think you're going to make upon the spot, upon the spur of the moment. It never turns out that way. The things that seem best and most inspired and most spontaneous at the moment are very seldom that. They're usually contrived, they're usually affected, and they're usually filled with all kinds of musical gadgetry that one doesn't really want in a recording.
You need that temporal displacement to really be objective.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
That means, then, that, strange to say, part of your artistic and creative process is going on in the editing situation.
It's editorial, absolutely. We know precisely what we want to do with that recording by the time we come to treat it as a finished product. We don't treat it as a finished product in the studio. We don't even think of it as that. I very often learn on company time, of course. Fortunately, CBS is very patient with me. But I think it's the only way to do it, because one gains ideas from actually trying things that one can't quite try at home, one can't quite try under concert circumstances. You don't dare experiment to that degree in a concert, and at home you don't quite have the tension of the moment to make it necessary and feasible to experiment that widely.
There are lots of critics and concertgoers, I think, would attach a kind of moral disapproval to that kind of behavior. It's not quite honest, perhaps.
Yeah, they feel that there's a certain amount of cheating involved, and of course there is, because, as you know, a recording very often consists of a collection of tape fragments that are quite carefully spliced together. A, to eliminate inaccuracies, finger faults of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. B, and much more important, to create a homogeneous entity out of that particular composition. We've put out a lot of music that consists of take one from start to finish. A lot of the Bach preludes and fugues, which are rather short pieces and hence no great achievement is involved, are take ones, with no splices of any kind.
Or a complete take three, yes. With no splicing.
Yes. On the other hand, some of the very best things we've done, and I'm thinking particularly of one fugue, the A minor from the first volume of the Volta Imperata Clavier, consisted of two extraordinary takes which were absolutely different in character and which miraculously matched each other, paced each other in tempi. And this is very unusual.
Why don't you illustrate what you're speaking of?
Right. Well, we played the A minor fugue about a year and a half ago at a session in two completely different ways, and in the first fashion, this was the way in which we phrased the subject. And that became what we called take six. Then we had a take eight. Take seven was rather a letdown, as I recall. And take eight sounded something like this. And in take eight, as you can see, there was a very Teutonic emphasis. It was very pompous, it was very grand, it was a little bit turgid, mm-hmm. and a little bit boring, and we felt that we couldn't go on indefinitely being that pompous about a phrase, a motivic idea that, on the whole, was rather light-hearted, even though its texture was quite thick. At the same time, we couldn't be quite as skittish as take six was either. Mm-hmm. So about a month later, sitting in the playback booth, we discovered that both these takes, take six and take eight, were accomplished in exactly the same amount of time. I don't remember what the minute and second hand read at the moment, but perhaps 3 minutes 20 for one, 3 minutes 22 for the other. Very close, in any event. Yeah. And we then found that it was possible, in effect, to make a constant shift of gear between take six and take eight, to use take eight, to use this pompous, rather turgid, rather Teutonic version of the theme and of its mm-hmm. corresponding answers, for all of the basic expository passages, and for all the episodic and fragmentary ones, to use take six, to lighten the texture as if one were shifting to the upper register of a harpsichord or whatever. And it made one of the very best fugues that we've put out, I think.
So you built your interpretation with the razor blade and the engineer.
Indeed, and we built it after the fact. We had no idea on the day of the session that it would turn out that way. We couldn't possibly have guessed at it, and I don't think that under any pressured circumstance, under concert condition, for instance, one could ever have arrived at something quite that, if I may use the word in quite the wrong place, inspired version. I think that it's very much easier to do that when you're dealing with Baroque music, let's say, which has no written-in tempo indications, and where composers like Bach provided few and far between dynamic indications, for that matter. One can obviously improvise a great deal within the framework that you're given. It's rather less easy to do it, and one is inclined to bring down critical wrath upon one's head if one does do it in romantic music, where things are written out to a fair nicety, or even in Beethoven, for that matter. I had a nice experience about 2 years ago. As you know, we recorded the Beethoven Emperor Concerto with mm-hmm. Leopold Stokowski, and that was great fun because I had never worked with him before. In fact, we had met only at a railroad station in Frankfurt on Main once, and I had heard that he disliked doing concertos, and I can't blame him for that at all, I must say. In any event, we came together about 3 days before the recording was to be done, and I said with some temerity, "Maestro, I have two thoughts about this piece, and I can't quite manage a decision as to which is preferable, if either, but I am going to suggest that we do it in one of two rather extreme ways, either very fast on the whole or very slow. And since I don't really believe in a great deal of rubato in Beethoven, I would suggest that we either have a particularly rapid Emperor concerto or possibly the slowest in history." And to my great delight, he opted for the slow version, which was very grandiose and Napoleonic and full of tassels on the shoulder, and in which the first theme, the primary theme of the first movement, sounded something like this. The option, which I'm happy to say he rejected, would have made the first theme sound like this. By comparison, I think it has no character at all. It has great virtuosic possibilities, has a certain kind of Toscanini-like continuum, perhaps, available to it. But ours didn't quite turn out as a Toscanini-like performance, I'm happy to say. I love it. That was a very happy experience.
Not at all Toscanini.
It was also very funny, because at the first rehearsal with the American Symphony, Stokowski, in his most elegiac frame of mind, mounted the podium, and he said, and you know, they're mostly young players who haven't had a great deal of experience with the standard concerto repertoires yet, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, remember the Eroica." That's exactly what we did. We did a sort of Eroica symphony with piano obbligato. Mm-hmm. That's why I love it, I think. The piano is kept down and it's kept in a very modest perspective.
That brings me to another subject which interests me. Your tempi tend generally not to fall into the routine and accepted tempi, the tempi that most concert audiences are prepared to hear out of habit. They tend either to be, in many cases, much faster, as you say, or much slower. Now, why is this? Is this sort of a perverse desire to do something different from what everyone else has done?
It's certainly perverse. I think that if there's any excuse at all for making a recording, it's to do it differently, to approach the work from a totally recreative point of view, that one is going to perform this particular work as it has never been heard before. And if one can't quite do that, I would say abandon it, forget about it, move on to something else where you can feel a little differently about it.
Is this because you want Glenn Gould to be different, or are you consciously trying to shock the audience into a totally new awareness?
I would like to shock them to the extent that from the first note they should be aware that something slightly different is about to happen. I want to get their attention, I suppose. It's like the traditional cannonade at the beginning of the Shakespeare performances or something. No, it's not quite as devastating as that, I hope. But I wouldn't want to take the nice, easy, mean line in a performance, if only because there are nice, easy, mean line performances available all throughout the Schwann catalog, and I would incline to buy those myself if that's what I wanted. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's much excuse for another Beethoven Fifth Concerto unless one has a totally different approach. Now, if that approach is based only on eccentricity, only on the idea that you want to shake people up and get dreadful reviews because of that shaking up that you're trying to instate, then forget it. Obviously, that's not a sufficient excuse to do anything. There has to be some quite convincing reason behind all that eccentricity. But if you can somehow manage to forge those two things to actually make a convincingly Beethovenian eccentricity that really does catch everyone unawares, then by all means do it. That's the excuse of making records, I'm sure.
I suppose that the rather baleful outlook toward this kind of activity is based on the fact that editing, tape splicing, is a rather arcane subject. A lot of people tend to regard it, I suppose, as an invention of the devil. Anything that, for instance, steps between a concert artist and his audience, they tend to regard with suspicion.
True. I think also they lay in wait upon occasion for a finger fault of some kind to show through, to mark it with its imperfection, and to give them the feeling that this was a human being, after all, who could, just as they could, have a life compounded of error. Mm-hmm. And they resent the fact that you can, in fact, virtually eliminate error. I think one can really treat tape as a film director treats his rushes. One can look at it the day after and say, now, what have we really got here? What can we do with this? What does this all mean?
Well, I think that's the way it should be. I mean, people don't object to editing in the creation of a film.
Exactly.
Why should they object to it in the creation of a long-playing record?
I can't see any reason that moral issues come into it at all. I never have done.
But it's interesting. What you're doing, in essence, is postponing your final artistic judgments about a performance till some time when you come back in a totally fresh, objective state of mind. However, isn't it true that what you choose on that day could also depend on the mood you're in that day, and that you might come back a year later and pick different takes? In other words, you might come back to tapes you've made of existing records 1 or 2 years later, select different takes, and make totally new performances that would satisfy you on that
day. That's very true. I'm all for the kit concept, of course. I'd love to issue a series of variant performances and let the listener
choose
decide what they themselves most like. Let them assemble their own performance. Give them all the component parts, all the component splices, rendered at different tempi with different dynamic inflections, and let them put something together that they really enjoy, make them participant to that degree.
I'd very much like to do that. That's an answer to alienation and the terrible uninvolvement of the public today.
Precisely.
Make artists of them.
Yeah, I think that's one way of absolutely drawing them into the recreative process as a starter, and perhaps indirectly into the creative process.
Well, you are a strange breed of recreative musical artist, Glenn. I mean, to start with, you have left the concert business, and you're in the record business, and the radio business, and the television business, all those places that concert artists are traditionally not supposed to be. Didn't you recently do an article for High Fidelity on the pop singer Pat Clark?
I did indeed. It was my first and quite probably last foray into the whole field of folk rock, or whatever they're calling it these days. It was great fun to do. What I found in it was a very strange dichotomy, because here, on the one hand, was a young lady, not so young anymore, my age if she's a day, talking about the experience of suburban disillusionment. And she had found that these suburban enticements were not quite what they were cracked up to be. So it was a very curious sense of the scale of disillusionment, of escalation and de-escalation in human ambition. At the same time, all of these ennui-filled sentiments were being portrayed musically by the simplest shifts of 4-5-1 cadences, such as would fill most of the Methodist song and anthem books circa 1850 and in the best post-Mendelssohnish tradition. There's a very, very curious dichotomy between the music that was being used and the words that were being applied to it. And I couldn't resist pulling this apart and finding exactly why this was and what it did for Petula Clark. I think one thing it did for her was to give her a very wide audience. She has the oldsters as well as the teenagers, and that's no small achievement in the pop rock field, certainly.
No, it isn't.
But more than that, it does somehow fit into the great North American scheme of things, and she is, of course, not a North American, but she has a North American appeal, essentially, the great North American scheme of things to split oneself and to have a tremendous vaulting ambition about the things that one wants to accomplish in one's life, the lights and the lures that one feels are downtown, and then to reject them once one has found them, which I suppose is why I'm not a city person, and to do all this within a certain sense of familial tradition, which is represented, I suppose, by the tonic and dominant and subdominant, the secure plagal chords of the Methodist hymn. And I found this quite fascinating. It may have been a very arbitrary and sort of post-Freudian glance at folk rock, and I don't intend to do it again. It was my first and last attempt. But it was great fun. And I believe in it in a way that I do not believe, for instance, in the music of the Beatles. I think that's stuff and nonsense. And pretentious, moreover.
Uh-huh. In other words, the music that the kids are interested in now doesn't really interest you.
I'm too old, I suppose, to side with that particular kind of anti-academic rebellion. And I suppose that one way that's what did attract me to the Pet Clark repertoire. It was not anti-academic. It was very pro-academy, as a matter of fact. It was very cautiously considered music as such.
Mm-hmm. In other words, then, you may even be a musical conservative.
Yes, I think really I am a musical conservative in many respects.
Your love of Strauss is one instance.
Yeah, well, certainly I don't see any contradictions about loving people who are terribly out of fashion these days. I don't think there's any great contradiction in loving Strauss, for instance, and loving Schoenberg, who was, in a sense, his arch-enemy. I can't see any reason that one love has to cancel out another. I think that's one of the great mistakes that people make today, and especially the avant-garde people make when they try to decide who's in, who's out, who's with it, and who's not. That's a great mistake, and I wish they'd stop it. It's also silly.
It's very often a function of creators, of composers, isn't it? That kind of creative myopia that tends to erect walls against what they're trying to fight or overcome.
Yeah, well, I think the blindfold for them is necessary, but I don't think they should propagandize on behalf of blindfolds for the rest of us and for the public at large. I think that's a great mistake. And there was, of course, a sort of Get Strauss movement initiated just after the war, just as there's a Get Sibelius movement today, you know. And that makes me very unhappy because intelligent people were behind both, in a sense, much too intelligent were they to be engaged in a movement that silly and that futile. They're not going to get Strauss. He's going to be one of the supreme creators of the 20th century.
Well, they won't get Sibelius either. I mean, no. I can remember down with Beethoven clubs when I was in college,
really?
Too. And I have a suspicion that he's survived it. You are interested in modern techniques and electronics, but I wonder, how do you feel about electronic music in general?
I'm inclined to think that it's the future, very much the future. I feel rather optimistic, not about what's been done up till now, but what can be done with electronic music. I think that a lot of doors are going to be opened there in the next few years, especially if we get some very good technicians involved in it. Because at the moment, most composers who are seriously engaged with it lack good technical advice.
Very
and they
true.
Also lack good production advice in terms of those efforts that are put out by major labels. For the most part, they're not well produced. I'm not speaking of Columbia. I'm not even thinking of Columbia at this moment.
I'd love to turn you and a Moog synthesizer loose in a studio and see what happens. You might find it very fascinating.
It might come out sounding like Richard Strauss. Be prepared for that eventuality.